Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program. This week my guest is physician Marcia Angel, senior lecturer in the Department of Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Angel joined the editorial staff of the New England Journal of Medicine in 1979, became executive editor in 1988, and was editor-in-chief from 1999 to 2000. Dr. Angel writes frequently in professional journals and the popular media on a wide range of topics, including medical ethics, health policy, the interface of medicine and law, and the relationship between industry and academic medicine. In 1997, Time magazine named Marcia Angel one of the 25 most influential Americans. Her critically acclaimed book, Science on Trial, The Clash of Medical Evidence and the Law in the Breast Implant Case, was published in 1996 by W.W. Norton and Company. And her most recent book is The Truth About Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us, and What to Do About It, published in 2004 by Random House. Marcia Angel, thanks for joining us on If You Love This Planet.
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Well, I've been, as a physician myself, I've been fascinated ever since I graduated in 1961 about the connection between drug companies and doctors. And so maybe we can start with that, and you can elucidate where the medical profession stands today and what the drug companies are up to. It's a big subject.
Sure. Doctors have to write the prescription.
Yep.
It's that simple. So that if drug companies can win the hearts and minds of physicians, then they have accomplished most of what they need to accomplish. And of course, drug companies are investor-owned industries, and their fiduciary responsibility is to maximize profits. And they do that by trying to win over and seduce physicians. As the companies have become richer and richer, they've become better able to do that. Until now, they're phenomenally successful.
Okay, so what are the techniques they use to win over our colleagues, Marcia?
Wherever two doctors are gathered together, so too is the pharmaceutical industry. They are behind every meeting of doctors. They, at least in this country, they subsidize most of the continuing medical education that doctors have to receive in order to maintain their licenses. They fund most professional societies and their meetings. They give dinners and lectures. They give out-and-out gifts. We have laws in the United States that prohibit drug companies from selling their drugs or promoting their drugs for uses for which they're not approved. And we have laws against giving doctors kickbacks to sell their drugs. But the drug companies have learned how to circumvent these laws by disguising their marketing activities as education. They say, well, we're not marketing, we're just giving doctors some information about how to treat depression. And so then they get to give kickbacks, and they get to market drugs off-label if they call it education, or if they call it research. So probably the principal way they win over doctors is simply by paying either directly or indirectly for their educational and professional activities.
Yes, well, I've noticed every time I go to Grand Rounds, which is the regular weekly meeting in a hospital to which most doctors attend, that often the meal or the morning tea and the like is paid for by drug companies.
Absolutely.
And that's become more and more common, and it just makes me feel sick, actually.
Yes, yes. Well, somehow they have managed to propagate the myth that they're educational institutions, that they're there to give you impartial, unbiased information about their drugs. And nobody stops, in medicine, stops to say, well, that makes no sense. You don't look to a company for impartial information about the product itself. It just is absurd, self-evidently. And we know that when it comes to other parts of our lives. I mean, if we wanted to know whether to buy a Toyota or a Honda, we wouldn't ask the Honda dealer. But somehow, doctors have convinced themselves that the drug companies are engaged in the same mission they are, that they really want the very best drugs for doctors' patients. And they may like to have that, but their primary obligation is to maximize profit.
But Marcia, I mean, most doctors are fairly intelligent. Do you really think that they believe that? I think they must be suppressing their IQ to a degree to be seduced and become almost prostituted to the drug companies. That's my feeling. They must know underneath if you got them in a sort of, if you put them on a truth machine or something, what's happening.
Well, that's an interesting question. It's very hard to know, isn't it? I mean, there's a difficult line between delusion and greed. And all of that money, the bounty that goes from drug companies to doctors, can kind of help them kid themselves or maybe help them not think too clearly about this, whereas in other aspects of life they would think clearly. It's quite a phenomenon.
Well, that's why I feel that we as a profession have prostituted ourselves to industry, the medical industrial industry, right?
Absolutely.
Or complex. Okay, well, let's go into this. Oh, and I know that drug companies, you know, they'll pay for doctors' trips in the weekend to a lovely meeting,
yes.
And it might be a hunting lodge or, you know, a golf club or...
That's right.
Now, I've got your article from the latest issue of the New York Review of Books.
Yeah.
You talk about three specific cases of psychiatrists, actually, who are at leading medical schools and who have been paid by drug companies, actually, an enormous amount to do the work. So I'm going to name them.
Uh-huh.
The first was Dr. Joseph J. Biederman, professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and chief of pediatric psychopharmacology at Harvard's Massachusetts General Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, thanks largely to him, children as young as 2 years old are now being diagnosed with bipolar disorder and treated with a cocktail of powerful drugs, many of which were not approved by the FDA for that purpose.
And
none of which were approved for children below 10 years of age. So can you briefly outline his story and how he got involved and what sort of money he's received and what he's up to?
Well, I don't have all the specifics right in front of me. This was a matter of public record. The Boston Globe had very complete stories on it, so did the New York Times. And while I don't have the details in front of me, he was doing something that's not at all unusual. What he was doing was research on the use of drugs for various psychiatric illnesses in children. At the same time, he was receiving payments from the companies that made those drugs for speaking on the subject, speaking about the drugs, or as a consultant. In various ways, he was receiving money from drug companies that made the drugs that he was not only studying, but also promoting. Now, where he was perhaps unusual, but hardly unique, is in the amounts of money he received and in the degree of his influence. After all, the Massachusetts General Hospital is a very important institution. And he is what is known as a key opinion leader. That is, somebody whose views influence many more people than those immediately in his area. I mean, the people who that give the CME courses, the people who write the papers. So he was highly influential. And he believed that bipolar disorder, which used to be thought not to occur in children, he believed it did occur in children. And he was...
Had he done any research to investigate the children before?
Yes.
You know,
yes, but, you know, psychiatric research is pretty difficult because there are not objective findings and they're not objectively verifiable criteria for diagnosis. Mm. So this was something that he believed in. And he promoted this idea, and he was so influential that, and others who agreed with him were so influential, that the diagnosis of bipolar disorder in children increased astronomically in the last 10 years, manyfold over the very tiny number of diagnoses before. So that now it's a common, commonly diagnosed disorder in children, and these drugs are used to treat it. So what he was doing was perhaps extreme, but was, for many of key opinion leaders, not all that unusual. The reason I mentioned him was because Senator Grassley, who is a senator in the U.S. Congress, has been investigating some of these relationships between people getting research money from the NIH, who were also getting money from drug companies. And he shone the spotlight on Dr. Biederman, and then it was picked up by the newspaper.
Yes, well, you say in this article that bipolar disorder in children now seems to be replacing the attention deficit hyperactive disorder.
Yes, yes. And that's, you know, that's because people are always in agony about difficult children. I mean, this is just the most terrible thing that can happen to parents. And
often it's a parental disability.
Yes. And you know, now, particularly in the United States, but I imagine elsewhere as well, with both parents working and working longer hours, and in the United States, there is almost no social support for families. You're on your own as far as daycare goes or having any time off to take your child to the doctor. So it's a very difficult life now for American families of young children. So when they have a difficult child, they search around for a diagnosis. And a diagnosis that doesn't blame them in any way. And also a diagnosis that will allow the medical care to be paid for. If you carry a medical diagnosis and your insurance will pay for these drugs, and if you don't, then you're on your own. So for a number of reasons, there has been a medicalization of the difficulties of childhood, and that shifts. It's attention deficit disorder, it's depression, and now it's bipolar disorder. It shifts. It's a sort of disease du jour, like the soup du jour, whatever is fashionable. And this is in now.
I'm interviewing Dr. Marcia Angel, who has authored a wonderful article, actually, in the recent edition of the New York Review of Books, Drug Companies and Doctors, A Story of Corruption. What Dr. Angel, are the symptoms of bipolar disorder in children as young as 2 years old?
Well, they seem to be fairly vague. But I as I read, and I'm not a psychiatrist, but as I read what's said about it, it seems to involve mood swings. But, of course, mood swings in children are very common, and particularly when you get up to the preteen, it almost defines the age group. So I guess one would say, well, it's severe mood swings. Well, what is severe? So it's very hard to pin that down. Even if you can pin it down, even if you say, okay, this is a real diagnosis and these are the symptoms, that doesn't necessarily mean these drugs are going to make them better. The drugs, in my view, might do a lot more harm than they do good, and that has to be established through randomized, controlled clinical trials in the usual way that you study a drug. But here you have both the diagnosis, it seems to me rather vague, mm-hmm. and you have the treatment, which is not well established.
And has the treatment been studied in these children?
In my opinion, I've read some of the research. It is very thin. I mean, much of it is not double blind. Much of it is not controlled or randomized. Very, very thin.
And probably paid for by the drug companies.
Oh, yes.
And so what drugs specifically are they using now for bipolar disorder in children?
Well, they're using the atypical antipsychotics, among others, drugs. I don't know what they are named in Australia. Do you call it Zyprexa?
No.
Risperdal?
We have different generic different names for drugs. Yeah.
Brand names, yeah. But the atypical antipsychotics, which have been found to be associated with very rapid weight gain, often with diabetes, or other metabolic abnormalities. So these are not. This is not a placebo. This is a powerful class of drugs. At least powerful in terms of the side effects. The benefits are much less clear.
I wonder what percentage of children now in the United States are actually on drugs for various quotes disorders. Do you have
Quite high. I don't have the figure right at hand now, but I've heard estimates of somewhere near 10%.
So what on earth are we doing to these children?
That's what I wonder.
I know.
That's what concerns me most about all of this. Because some children are taking not just one drug, but a handful of drugs.
And this is the developing brain. So as well as that, they probably are watching television many hours a day.
Probably.
And also probably using their cell phones. And there's evidence now that cell phones can induce cerebral tumors.
I'm not so sure.
You don't agree with the...
I don't accept that, but still.
Yeah, I... It's going to be a lost generation. And then now there's another man called Dr. Alan Schatzberg, chair of Stanford's psychiatry department, president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, here again, this is someone that Senator Grassley brought to attention and was covered extensively in the media. And his situation is a little bit different. He founded a company that makes a drug that is being developed for the treatment of something called psychotic depression. This is very serious depression. And at the same time, he had he was principal investigator in an NIH grant, National Institutes of Health, a government grant to study psychotic depression. And part of this grant was to look at this particular drug made by the company that he founded and partly owned. So here he was with a government grant to study a drug made by his own company. Now, this is a clear conflict of interest. Stanford, which is the institution for which he's a faculty member, thought this was okay. But Stanford, too, originally had an interest in the company. It was a startup company. And in fact, Stanford owns the patent on this drug because the individual at a medical school doesn't own the patent, the institution does. So Stanford had an interest in thinking it was okay. Stanford eventually gave up its stock in this company, but still gets some royalties from licensing this patent. So both Stanford and Dr. Schatzberg seem to think that there was nothing wrong with this. And in my article, I highlight this conflict of interest and a slightly different situation from Dr. Biederman.
Well, now it's a fascinating drug, mifepristone.
Yes, yes.
And it's also the abortion drug,
right.
RU486. How on earth does that have psychiatric implications, that the abortion drug? Can you explain
that? Well, it has not received FDA approval.
Mm.
So who knows? That's another issue. You see, when you get a patent on a drug, you get the patent for a particular use. And
yeah.
This drug had not been patented for that use. And so Dr. Schatzberg was able to obtain the patent for Stanford for that particular use, even though it's an old drug that's used to induce abortion.
And then there's Dr. Charles B. Nemiroff.
Yes.
Chair of Emory University's Department of Psychiatry, and along with Schatzberg, co-editor of the influential textbook on psychopharmacology.
Yes.
What did he do, Dr.
Well,
Angel?
Well, it's a story similar to Dr. Biederman's, but maybe more extreme, in which he was, like Dr. Biederman and Dr. Schatzberg, is fairly important in the psychiatric establishment, has a lot of influence, a key opinion leader. Key opinion leaders, incidentally, that's the name given to them by the pharmaceutical industry.
They're called KOL, aren't they?
KOL,
yeah.
Right. And these are the people that they're particularly eager to woo, the pharmaceutical industry. So they just lavish attention and money on them. And so Dr. Nemiroff was getting huge amounts of money from many, many drug companies. At the same time, he was writing scholarly articles about the use of these drugs in various psychiatric conditions. And there is some issue as to whether he adequately reported this income.
Yeah, millions of dollars. Now, it's as you point out, Marcia Angel, that psychiatric disorders, so-called, are really terrific things for drug companies because they're not extremely clear in their signs and symptoms. They vary from patient to patient, and they can be almost manipulated by drug companies, if you will, because there are no actual tests to determine a psychiatric disorder.
Yeah.
Drug companies to use, you know, their various chemicals on these patients, and then there's the advertising, as well as manipulating doctors and researchers and medical institutions and medical schools. Then we can come to the television advertising of these various drugs. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, the drug companies spend roughly $5 billion a year in the United States advertising their products on television. Now, they're not allowed to do that in other countries. I don't believe they're allowed to do that in Australia. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, they're just creeping in a little tiny bit, but not like in America where it's so embarrassing. I mean,
right.
They're talking about people's hemorrhoids bleeding and erectile dysfunction. Guys, oh yeah, we've got one of a guy going who has prostatic obstruction and going to the lavatory at night and, you know, a very thin and interrupted urinary stream. Actually, that's just started to appear. Standing there in his pajamas, you know, looking between his legs with his wife with a very worried look on her face.
Well, it's all the camera crew in there that worried her, I guess. We have this constantly, And if you'll notice, it's usually advertisements on programs that are directed mainly to older people.
Mm.
Programs that young people don't much watch. For example, the evening news. Only old people watch the evening news anymore. And then you'll see those drug advertisements one after the other. In fact, about half of the news program is taken up by advertisements.
Especially for erectile dysfunction. I love that.
Right, right. and what you will see in all these ads is that they're not necessarily advertising the drug, they're advertising the condition.
Mm.
They want as many people as possible to believe they have a condition for which there is a drug that will cure them or ameliorate it for the rest of their lives. These are chronic conditions. They're often lifestyle conditions like erectile dysfunction because they're more normal people than there are sick people, and it's a bigger market. So if they can convince millions of essentially normal people that they have a condition that should be treated with a drug, then they've really increased their market. And they're usually fairly vague conditions, too, because that way nobody's going to say, well, you don't have that condition. So what you see in these ads is trying to convince people that if they have any indigestion after they eat a Big Mac, that they have acid reflux disease, and unless they treat it, they're going to get cancer of the esophagus. Or to try to convince them that if they feel shy at a cocktail party, which everyone does, that they have something called
social anxiety disorder.
Right, and so they need a drug for that. Or to convince them that if they don't have 100% sexual performance like they had when they were 25, they have a condition called erectile dysfunction, and there's a treatment for that.
Of course, there's no equivalent in women like orgasmic dysfunction, is there?
Well, there was some push to promote these drugs for failure to achieve orgasm in women, too. And there was some resistance to that, but they're still working on that. So everybody in America is either sick or doesn't know it yet. Everybody's either taking drugs or they're about to take drugs for these conditions. And even conditions that are important, like high blood pressure or very high cholesterol, what you see is a broadening of the definition so that people who probably don't have high cholesterol or high blood pressure are encouraged to take drugs for them. It's an expanding of the market, and it's an advertising of the disease as much as the drugs.
And very brilliant advertising too, sort of subliminal messages, and they use music in a sort of sexy way and an appealing way. I mean, advertising now has reached almost its pinnacle in influencing people's behavior, I think, to a degree.
It's incredible. There's one drug for erectile dysfunction, and there is a beautiful, young, healthy-looking couple, but they're both in bathtubs in the country, and it looks pretty nice up there in the mountaintop in the bathtub. I've never seen a bathtub on the mountain. But they sit there, they hold hands, and...
What, they're outside in the bathtub, are they?
They're outside
in the mountains.
Bathtub, right. They're out in the woods in the bathtub.
God.
And so it looks pretty neat. And then they're told that they might need this drug for erectile dysfunction. When the drug for erectile dysfunction first came on the market, they were promoted by older people, like there was one member of Congress.
Bob Dole.
It was Bob Dole. And, you know, that made sense. And then they started moving from, I mean, they stopped with Bob Dole, and then they started going to quarterbacks on football teams. And suddenly their market expanded. It wasn't just old men who may have had vascular disease or diabetes or some reason for sexual dysfunction. It was for young men who just kind of wanted a better performance or thought they would get a better performance.
Okay, so let's move on to Neurontin. I don't know what Neurontin is. I don't know who makes it and what it's used for. Can you explain what Neurontin is and how it's being used?
Well, Neurontin is now owned by Pfizer, which is the biggest drug company in the world. It first came on the market made by another drug company that was swallowed up eventually by Pfizer. And it came on the market for a very narrow use. It was approved. You can't promote a drug. Incidentally, I'm just going to interrupt myself, but you can't promote a drug until it's been approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for a particular use. And their approval depends on the manufacturer showing in clinical trials that the drug is reasonably safe and effective. So Neurontin had been approved by the FDA for a very narrow use, for people who had epilepsy that had not responded to other epilepsy drugs. So Neurontin could be added on in this very special and rather small group of people. Well, they weren't going to have a big-selling drug that way. In the U.S., a big-selling drug, a drug that sells more than $1 billion worth per year, is called a blockbuster. And every company wants their drug to be a blockbuster, and this was not going to be a blockbuster if it were used for this use. So what they did then was to begin to promote it for almost every use you can imagine, every subjective vague use anyway. They began to promote it for migraines. They began to promote it for bipolar disorder, for restless leg syndrome, for just
post-traumatic stress.
As a sort of all-purpose tonic, everybody was taking Neurontin, even though it hadn't been approved for these uses. It eventually got approved for post-herpetic pain, but other than that, all these other uses were off-label. Now, as I said, it's illegal to promote a drug for a use not approved by the FDA, but Neurontin was able to do this by disguising it as education and research. So, for example, they would write a paper or hire a company to write a paper that said, in my experience, Neurontin is good for migraines. And then they would pay a key opinion leader to sign that paper.
So the drug company writes the paper.
Yeah, well, they were higher writing companies.
Yeah, higher writing companies, yeah.
Their agents were doing it. And then they would pay key opinion leaders to...
Like a professor of psychiatry at some medical school.
Right, to put his name on there. And then they would pay for neurologists or doctors to come to Hawaii to play golf and listen to talks about whatever it was, say migraines. And then they would pay other people to come and listen to those talks. And then they would say, and here is a paper that so-and-so has written showing that Neurontin is good for migraines. And so in doing this, then, they had disguised the marketing as education. They had circumvented the law against off-label marketing. In the case of Neurontin, the company had done so much of this. It became a huge blockbuster, over $2 billion a year in sales. They did so much of this that they crossed a line and they had to plead guilty to criminal and civil charges and pay a huge fine to settle those charges.
$430 million.
Right. But still, that's not much compared with the $2 billion that they were making in sales. And so people still use Neurontin, and they use it much too often, and they use it for unapproved uses. And the fine, as big as it was, really was just a cost of doing business for Pfizer.
So the laws are relatively weak, and that's a gentle term, for controlling these sort of, and I have to say, you know, as a as a physician, and I suppose you too, that I think these activities could be labelled, if there was a real investigation into this, as illegal in terms of the public health of the people of certainly the United States, but across the world. Is that going too far?
I think that there are laws that need to be changed, and I think one of the laws here is obvious, and that is to get rid of this loophole that excuses education and research from the laws against off-label marketing and kickbacks. That would take care of it.
I'm interviewing Dr. Marcia Angel, who was previously the editor-in-chief of the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine, and her most recent book is The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us and What to Do About It, published in 2004 by Random House. Let's move on then from advertising to the general public, who don't understand what's going on at all, to specifically explaining what the book is called, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Medical Disorders, how it evolved from 1952 to where it is now, and who runs it and writes in it.
Yeah. Well, you had said earlier, Helen, that that psychiatric disorders present a special problem because there is no objectively verifiable way to diagnose them. It's a matter of judgment. And that's why it is so important in psychiatry, probably more than almost any other field, that diagnoses and treatment be done and evaluated by experts who have no financial interest in the companies that make the drugs. That is not true, either for diagnosis or for treatment, in the case of psychiatry now. Diagnosis depends almost entirely on the DSM that began in 1952, and this is a compendium of diagnoses of psychiatric condition, the names of the diagnoses, descriptions of them, how the symptoms, how it can be the diseases, the disorders can be diagnosed. And it's the Bible of psychiatric diagnoses. It's used in the law. It's used in institutions. It's used by insurance companies. If it's in the DSM, then it's a bona fide diagnosis, and it'll include how to make the diagnosis. Mm. The problem is that this book has never depended on published evidence. That is, whatever the factual statements in the book, they do not require themselves, the authors, to say this has been demonstrated in the following randomized control clinical trials.
That's amazing, that very fact in itself.
It's just the judgment of the people who write the book. And the people who write the book have always, but more so now in the recent editions, have been on the payroll of the drug companies. They are paid as consultants or as speakers, even while their opinion determines what is a bona fide diagnosis. Not surprisingly, then, over the years, the number of diagnoses in this book has increased like Topsy. I mean, it started being just a little spiral notebook. Incidentally, it's published by the American Psychiatric Society. Mm-hmm. And so it was a little notebook for its members, by and large, when it first was created. But now it is a huge book with just many, many conditions listed. It is a big moneymaker, too, for the American Psychiatric Association, because everybody has to have this book as a reference, and so it makes millions a year for the American Psychiatric Association. It's now going through its fifth revision. I think the revision is due out in a couple of years, And the authors, the task force that's doing this, and their advisors are still predominantly working for the drug companies in one way or another, getting some payments. Now, they are now limiting the amounts that they can get directly from drug companies, and they're requiring disclosure, something that's new, they haven't done before. But it doesn't change the fact that those conflicts of interest are still there. The mere fact that they're disclosed or that they're limited doesn't make them go away.
Mm. I've got friends who are psychiatrists who say now psychiatry isn't really counseling people or Freudian or Jungian or any of the other therapeutic modes, but it's mostly now chemical treatments because of the DSM, this book, and because of the influence of drug companies, and that there's very little real psychiatric counseling and diagnosis. Would you comment on that, Dr. Angel?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And one reason is that we're probably the only civilized country that doesn't have a national health system.
Yeah.
We have a system of competing private insurers. Many Americans are uninsured or underinsured. And one problem is that someone who does need psychiatric care, psychotherapy, there's no way to pay for it because the insurance companies don't want to. It's time intensive. And so if you just write out a prescription, which takes 2 minutes, you've saved 50 minutes of time, and it'll be paid for. So, or for people who are fairly well insured, it'll be paid for. So that's another reason that there's been a real shift away from psychotherapy and in favor of the drug treatment of almost every discontent anybody has.
So psychiatrists really are not counseling people or doing psychotherapy at all. They, you know, you go in to see a psychiatrist, say, I'm very depressed, and he or she will sort of listen a little bit to your story and then write out a script.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yes. I mean, that's an exaggeration, perhaps.
Mm.
Many insurance plans will give a patient a limited amount of psychotherapy,
mm.
so many visits per year. But, yeah, that's the general situation.
You know,
writing out a prescription is better.
For comparison, we in Australia and most Western nations now have free medical care.
Yes.
And recently, partly because of the efforts of my sister, who's a psychologist, not an MD, you can be recompensed for psychological counselling and visits an hour at a time by our free medical care system, paid for by our tax dollars.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why or how it came about that employers have to pay employees health insurance instead of the government doing it. I don't understand that very clumsy and really unfair way of caring for people's health in the United States. How did it happen, Dr. Angel?
Well, they don't have to pay for people's
health
insurance.
No, they don't have to pay, but they...
No, it's a completely voluntary.
Right.
And what we're seeing now is employers are choosing not to,
yeah.
as the economic situation gets worse, or if they do cover their employees, they cover them for a much smaller benefit package, or they cap their contributions. They give a little bit of money toward it, but mainly the employee himself or herself has to make up the difference and carry the brunt of the inflation. So the employer-based system is shrinking even as we speak because it isn't required. And so our healthcare system in the United States is really collapsing.
Oh, dear.
Very, very sick.
And insurance is so expensive, is it not?
Yes. Yes, it is. It is. And going up rapidly. There's no way, there's no regulation that can keep it down that can regulate prices or regulate benefits. So as premiums go up, the actual insurance package goes down. The coverage goes down. Because the best way for these thousands of insurance companies to compete with one another for employers' business is to shrink the services. Then they get to keep more's profit. So they just cut the medical services. They avoid, if they can, insuring high-risk people at all. They just refuse to do it. And then if they have a bunch of healthy people they've insured, if they get sick, they can say, well, we don't cover that disease.
Yeah.
And that way they can keep their profits up.
So what happens then to really sick, so-called high-risk people? What happens to them if they can't?
To the people who don't have insurance?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they go on Medicaid, which is a government program for poor people. But often they just don't get care. They simply don't get care.
Like in the third world.
Very much like that, because what you're seeing now is a multi-tiered system, just like in the third world, so that people who are wealthy, they can get the best care in the world.
Yep.
And poor people don't get any care, and the people in the middle get some kind of stripped-down care, where you know part of their care is paid for, but they're high deductibles, high co-payments. And that's where most Americans have been, in that middle group. And what you're seeing is that is shredding too.
Well, is there much written about this by our colleagues, Dr. Angel, in medical journals? Is there an outcry about what is happening to the health system in the United States?
There is, but they're avoiding the obvious.
Yeah.
That is, there is an ideology in the United States that whatever your problem, the best solution is a market solution.
Yeah.
And so people say, well, we can't have a single-payer system. We can't have a universal system like other civilized countries have.
Nationalized medical.
Because Americans don't do that. Americans don't want the government to run anything. Americans like the free market, which ignores the fact that the most popular part of our healthcare system is Medicare, which is a government-run system. It's the system for older people over the age of 65. Much more efficient, much better system than the private system. But people don't look at that. They just say Americans want the market. And even President Obama, who earlier in his political career came out in favor of a single payer system, won't touch it now.
Really?
So what? Oh, no. No, no. So what he wants to do is to keep the same system in place but expand it. He's just expanded something called SCHIP, which is a program for children. And he wants to get the current system, which consists of multiple little fragments of health care, and expand it. But that's going to cost more money. If you don't change the system, you run into this dilemma. Anything you do to increase coverage will increase costs. And anything you do to lower costs will lower coverage. I mean, there's no way to both increase coverage and hold down costs. So he's running into that. And so he's planning on increasing the cost, pouring more money into a system that already costs Americans twice as much per person as the average for the OECD countries.
Corrupt system.
Just pouring more money into a bad system.
Obviously, he's been got at. But let's now talk, Dr. Angel, about the influence of drug companies and the medical insurance companies upon politics, politicians in both state and the federal government, and indeed the president. What influence and power do these companies have, this medical industrial complex?
Yeah. Well, it's enormous. The U.S. Congress is largely a Congress of special interest. It costs so much to win office in this country that even the best of the senators and representatives come into office owing a huge debt of gratitude to the special interests that put them there. The pharmaceutical industry and the private health insurance industry have two of the largest lobbies in Washington, just huge lobbies. And the pharmaceutical industry in particular has never faced a law from Congress that it did not favor. It has always gotten what it's wanted. Mm. So, for example, when a few years ago the U.S. Congress passed a drug benefit for Medicare recipients, for older people, senior citizens, the pharmaceutical industry was able to put provision into this bill saying that Medicare would not be able to bargain with the drug companies for prices. They had to pay whatever was asked. Now, that's an extraordinary thing to have in a law, but that's the power of the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, well, several things come to mind. I was recently in Washington, D.C., and I was not sleeping well because of jet lag. So I went to a CVS pharmacy to get about, I think, 20 temazepam Normacin sleeping pills. I think I had to have a script. And I came in and I wanted it. And they said, well, that'll be $92. I said, what? In a very loud voice. And in a louder voice said, I'd rather stay awake all night, and marched out of the shop. And they said, well, you're lucky. You're a doctor. You got it cheaply. I could not believe it. The most we pay here for most drugs is $5.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, because...
For what, a month's supply?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm hypertensive and I've got a high cholesterol. And so I'm on a multitude of drugs, which are actually necessary. And I will go and get my supply. And actually, the most I pay for all of them together is about $7.50.
Oh, that's just amazing. It really is. You can spend thousands of dollars a year here on just an ordinary, I mean, what you're describing, an ordinary couple of drugs. And you know, one of the things the pharmaceutical industry has been successful in doing, and earlier when you were asking why do doctors believe so much in this, they have convinced us that newer drugs are likely to be better than old ones, that there's a new miracle coming along every day. And in fact, there isn't. So what they do is they push these very expensive brand name drugs when often there's a generic drug or an older drug that's much less expensive. So people who spend thousands of dollars a year in the United States on their drugs probably could get just as good treatment, maybe better, by taking generic drugs or cheaper drugs and maybe spend a couple hundred a year.
Are those Me Too? What are Me Too drugs?
Me Too drugs are drugs that are very similar to usually very lucrative drugs already in the market. For example, if you look at the drugs to lower cholesterol called statins, Lipitor is a statin, and I don't know what you call it, but it's the top-selling drug in the world.
We call it Lipitor.
And there are about six drugs in this category. And so every time one of them is coming close to going off patent, they make a slightly a similar drug, name it something else, get a new patent, and promote it as though it were better than the older one. But they never really test them head-to-head at equivalent doses, so that you just have to take their word for it that this is what you ought to be taking. And so doctors tend to believe this, that new drugs are better, because they have a certain American faith in technology, that technology is always going to come up with something better. And that may be true in computers, but it certainly doesn't seem to be true in prescription drugs.
And human bodies.
Yes.
We're almost out of time, Marcia Angel. We didn't even get into the fact that drug companies do virtually no research on the biggest killers in the world that affect developing countries where they make little profit, like malaria and other such diseases where a lot of work is necessary. And I guess I'd say this, and you can comment on this, that I think responsibility for this dreadful mess in medical care in the United States rests at our feet, at the feet of physicians who, as you say beautifully in this article in the New York Review of Books, the responsibility of doctors and medical schools is to educate the next generation of physicians, carry out scientifically important research, and care for the sickest members of society. It's not to enter into lucrative commercial alliances with the pharmaceutical industry.
I believe that. I mean, I believe that the greatest blame belongs to our profession, Helen. The drug companies, in a sense, are just doing
what they do.
They're maximizing profit.
So, Marcia, how can we organize a revolution in medicine?
Well, we're doing our part.
I'm serious. No, I'm really serious.
We can hope.
Oh, I know you. Yeah, we can put our heads together and work it out. Anyway, look, thank you so much for this absolutely fascinating interview, and I hope people have received many insights into what is going on in medical care in the United States. Just even look at Canada, and there's such a huge difference just to the north.
Yeah.
And I thank you, Marcia Angel, very much for this fascinating interview.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Thank you. My guest today was physician and author Marcia Angel, senior lecturer in the Department of Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Angel's most recent book is The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us and What to Do About It, published by Random House and available through Amazon.com. If you would also feel impelled to support this program, if you go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org, you can certainly contribute financially to us. We need to be sustained financially to keep this show on the road, so to speak. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.